Okay. So our next presenter, we're going to go from looking at a policy initiative and approach at the local level, at a county level, to national policy. Our next presenter is Michelle Simon. Michelle has been doing food policy and activism and advocacy, as well as alcohol policy and looking at corporate responsibility issues for many years. I got to know her shortly after she had begun working at what used to be called Marin Institute, is now Alcohol Justice, and a good ally in the field for us all. And she currently is the president of her own consulting practice doing corporate accountability around food and alcohol issues. So with no further ado, I'd like to introduce Michelle Simon. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, Linda. So this is really fun for me because, you know, having worked in the food policy realm for years and then kind of skipped over to alcohol for a few years and now back in food but really doing both or wanting to do both issues and looking for opportunities to bring these worlds together because, you know, what I always say about APHA is all of my peeps are in one place, which is great, but we still tend to kind of, as Linda said, stay in our silos. And so I really thank you, Linda, for, you know, trying to break that down. And so I'm going to do part of my presentation about this report that I put out earlier in the year. But then I want to quickly kind of get to where some of these crossover issues are, because what really is at the heart of my work is getting folks to connect the dots. So when, you know, pharmaceutical industry or the tobacco industry or the alcohol industry or the food industry says it's all up to individuals. Oh my God, we're going to have job losses, right? These are the same arguments that we hear over and over across issues, and it's really important to say that because it's never about the specific issue that we're talking about. So hopefully we'll have some discussion about that. Well, hang on, let me give you some backdrop to why I wrote this report. So you might have heard this thing in food policy called the Farm Bill, and it's this huge mystery, I know. You probably wish you hadn't, but it's a huge mysterious piece of legislation that comes around every 5 years. And I wanted to take a look at the politics of it, but really what I found out was most of the politics are in a section of the bill around food stamps. And so I decided to take a look at this from a public health lens because groups weren't really doing that. So you might remember back in 2010, a big sort of firestorm was caused when the city of New York proposed a pilot project to not allow food stamps to be used for sugary sweetened beverages. And, you know, it seems like a logical idea, right? Why are our tax dollars going for a product that has no nutritional value, actually causes harm? And yet it didn't go anywhere because of the huge controversy around it. So that got my interest in looking at, well, what is the role of the food industry when it comes to this massive part of the Farm Bill? So just to give you some background, back in the 2008 version of the Farm Bill, food stamps, or what's now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, represented about two-thirds of the Farm Bill expenditures. Now, because of increases in the rolls, that's up to 80% of Farm Bill expenditures, which is pretty mind-blowing, because probably if you've heard rhetoric around the Farm Bill, you're hearing mostly about the commodity title, which has to do with subsidies, and of course we subsidize all the wrong commodity crops that contribute to our highly processed and meat-centered diet. But actually, there's this huge chunk of change, and now it's over $70 billion a year with enrollment at 46 million people. So that's almost 1 in 6 Americans are now on food stamps. It's a really important program. 4 million in California alone. I'm in California. Woohoo! Thanks for coming to my town. It's nice not having to travel to the East Coast this year. But the other thing is about SNAP is that almost half of all participants are children, which often gets left out of the equation. But it's a really important program for helping to get people out of poverty. And I should also tell you from a political backdrop, the sort of tenor in Congress right now, or has been with the debate of the Farm Bill, which came to a standstill, in the lead up to the election, has been to cut the program, right? This vitally important program, right? More and more people are out of work needing to take advantage of this program, and yet the Senate proposed $4 billion in cuts, and the House is gunning for even deeper cuts with $16 billion. So this is part of the debate that's going forward now, and actually part of what has kept the Farm Bill from even getting passed. And by the way, it expired the end of September, which hardly ever happens and is kind of unprecedented. But that's how broken our political system is in Congress right now. So what's interesting about the history of food stamps, so, you know, all this controversy, right, about, oh my God, you know, we can't tell poor people what to eat and we can't restrict food stamps, et cetera. Well, the original program in 1939 was really meant to help farmers. It was a way to take surplus commodity crops and buy them from farmers and then provide, you know, people who are hungry with those foods. And so the foods would actually change week to week. And yet that, of course, all went away over time, but it is an important historical note. And then in 1996, you might remember the era of welfare reform under President Clinton actually made the program much less friendly and harder to participate in. We changed that in 2000. We expanded the program, and that's when this new system of electronic benefit transfer, these EBT cards, came into play. And then 2010 was when all hell broke loose with this proposal to simply not allow food stamps to. And I should say, in the interest of crossover, so pretty much all food goes with food stamps. The only restrictions are no tobacco, no alcohol, which, you know, I think we could all agree makes a lot of sense. And then, but oddly, no supplement, like dietary supplements. So, you know, you can buy Coke, but you can't buy vitamin C, you know, go figure. So this issue of whether to use food stamps for soft drinks actually came up way back in 1964. And at the time, it was debated on the floor of the Senate, and Senator Paul Douglas made a passionate plea for not allowing food stamps for the use of soda by saying, I don't want to include Coke or Pepsi, any of that family. They are not valuable for the diet. They can be a waste of money, especially for young people. Personally, I think it's a great mistake to include them. Right? And this is before we had, you know, the Red Center or all these other groups. Even CSPI, I think, was probably not yet born in 1964. So in other words, way before we began focusing on soda as a public health menace. So a lot of people say, well, you know, people on food stamps, is their diet any worse than the average American? This is a slide that answers that question according to the USDA's own healthy index, healthy eating index. And so the way I answer this question is that most Americans eat a poor diet, and SNAP participants are just a representative sample of most Americans. So this shows that there's slightly, it's all bad, right? So if we look at all ages, healthy eating indexes for the SNAP participants is 52. For the high end of non-participants, it's at 58. It's not that much of a difference. Right? The point is that we shouldn't really be talking about SNAP participants as having any particularly bad, you know, dietary practices. They just eat like every other American, which is really bad. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is my schematic, and it worked really hard on this, so I want to explain it. And it helps understand how SNAP works, and it helps really kind of bring in these corporate actors. And so the left-hand side is sort of the administrative part of it. But then the right-hand side is where you start to see why there would be so much interest from specific corporate players in this program. Turns out the banks have an important role to play. So the money that flows through the participant card, you know, from Walmart. So a person goes to Walmart, let's just say, for example, where in some cities half of all retail dollars are spent at Walmart, you know, gives the SNAP card. The money actually gets reported through a bank like J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan contracts with states, as an example, it turns out J.P. Morgan Chase has contracts in half the states to administer the EBT card portion of the program, and they get a fee. So every participant that signs up on SNAP, J.P. Morgan gets to make more money, ka-ching. So, you know, poverty goes up and J.P. Morgan shares go up, I guess. So that's why how they have a role. And then it's obvious how big retailers like Walmart, you know, a lot of people shopping at their stores with food stamp dollars, and then, of course, the food manufacturers. So I was trying to really tease out with this research, you know, how much do these various players make? From this, again, over $70 billion a year, the largest by far food assistance program in our government, can't really answer that question because the federal government is hiding the information or doesn't bother to collect it. So the bank fees, I could find out from a few states here and there, but I had to go state by state. There's no national data collection on how much the banks are making. Similarly with the food manufacturers. So you might think for a nutrition program, it would be a good idea for the federal government to collect data, right, on, well, how much money are folks spending on Coca-Cola versus orange juice or water or carrots or, you know, anything that actually has nutrition in it. And the government doesn't collect that data. They do collect retailer data because they have to in order to reimburse the retailers, but they say that data is secret. So I wasn't able to find out too much about that, and that's a huge lack of transparency. So who fought the New York City proposal? The usual suspects, the Food Marketing Institute, Grocery Manufacturers Association, the Snack Food Association, my favorite, the National Confectioners Association, American, they're the Candy Lobby, American Beverage Association, and unfortunately, all the big anti-hunger groups that say they you know, represent poor people. A number of states have attempted to pass SNAP bills. I just want to call your attention to a quote from the state senator in Florida, Republican, by the way, who said that the Coca-Cola soda companies, chip companies, fought her because they know that they're raking it in from food stamps. So I want to get to the tactics again because this will help with this crossover piece of it. So industry lobbying tactics, this kind of applies in general, but this is how it played out with this particular issue. The number one tactic is to change the topic, right? Because they can't really fight us on the merits of the issue, right? There's no good reason for spending federal tax dollars on Coca-Cola. And so they find other things to talk about. And one of the things they would talk about with this issue was too complicated. You know, retailers can't figure out how to separate Coke. But somehow they figured out how to separate alcohol and tobacco, but never mind. And then this idea that we can't tell what's a good food. You know, oh, really, we don't know. Nutrition's so complicated. By the way, most other nutrition programs actually have a dietary guide, like the school meal program. Goes by the national dietary guidelines. Like, we have nutrition standards for other food assistance programs. And then another common tactic is claiming to care about poor people, right? We hear this a lot in the taxing issue. Oh, my God, you know, poor people, they're going to have to pay more in taxes. Well, for this issue, they said it was stigmatizing to say that people couldn't buy certain products. And then choice, right? It's all about choice in this country. What's more red, white, and blue than choice? And so the Candy Lobby was so worried that children could be denied treats during these holidays and that shouldn't parents be able to make the decision about treats should be offered? I mean, really going pretty far afield to make that kind of argument. So these are my recommendations in the report, and you can see the full report at eatfoodpolitics.com about better transparency and also giving states the ability to experiment, right? Because states want to experiment, want to do something similar to what New York City proposed, but they can't do it because USDA won't give them the authority. We need to get Congress to require that. And then I want to talk a bit more about similarities in corporate tactics. So, you know, this is kind of my big picture thinking about how corporations go about their talking points. The first is to market the hell out of dangerous products, right? Whether we're talking about tobacco, alcohol, or junk food. And then turn around and blame people for not taking personal responsibility, right? I mean, the food industry spends, you know, by some estimates, like $6 billion marketing alcohol, $36 billion marketing food. I don't know what the latest tobacco figures are, but, you know, they're spending a lot of money getting you to not take personal responsibility, but then it's your fault, you know, when you don't. And then the other name of the game is to lobby government agencies to weaken regulations. I mean, it's pretty obvious, but what they then do is then turn around and boast about how they're following these same toothless government standards, right? Oh, well, we're not doing anything wrong. Look, we're following the rules that they made be incredibly weak and easy to follow. And then the other pattern we see is creating these bogus voluntary self-regulation system. So in terms of advertising, this is a common thread between alcohol and food. And I used to think when I worked in food, oh, alcohol, they've got a great self-regulatory system. It's just as bad, even worse in some ways, and it's all a dismal failure. And then finally, there's hiring third-party experts, right? A very common tactic across industry to distort science information, creating front groups for, it's really about public disinformation campaign. And I want to end on, you know, I've been working a lot on Proposition 37 here in California, which is to label genetically engineered food. And I thought they were skipping over me, the no campaign, which is putting out lie after lie after lie. But I got a mailer. I was so happy. I finally got a mailer from the no campaign. And I mean, it's so absurd where to begin. You know, Prop 37 promoters have one thing on their mind. Oh, how clever. Ha, ha, ha. Food on the mind. I mean, money on the mind. Whatever. And then it talks about trial lawyers and, you know, this easy target guy who's helping to support the yes side. The point is that we are engaged in a massive fight over propaganda. And that's really what corporations are about. They're about shaping the public discourse in their favor, and they've been doing it for decades. So all of these ways that we are trying to fight is fighting against that. And I'm done. I'm just going to stop. So good time. Thank you very much.